This is the Creativity Podcast,
Episode 5.
Murphy's Satellite. I was a sculptor traveling down south for a show with my girlfriend, the one who calls me Romeo. Out on the prairie late on a Tuesday night, when I saw it, my first satellite. And when I asked her if the rain had hurt her face, she said it didn't matter anyway, we'd seen the satellite. I always loved her from the second after that. Nothing inside me had ever made me feel so great. Sometimes she held me in the warmth of her embrace. I always remember my first satellite. And then she tried to hold me down. I knew I'd wandered off the track into the wrong side of town.
Hello and welcome to Creativity number 5. My name is Harlan and...
My name is Adrienne.
And we were starting there with a track by our guest, John May, who will be joining us later. That's from his 2002 album, Boho Solo. And the track is My First Satellite. What did you think of that, Adrienne?
I think he's got a most gorgeous voice. Mm. And when you see and meet him in person, he's so incredibly modest about that aspect of himself and his work. But I think it's a lovely little track. And like John himself, very quirky. So, yeah, I really liked it.
I heard it and mentioned to him in an email that to me, there was something Bob Geldof about that song, which is a very good thing from my point of view.
I don't know enough about Bob Geldof, to be honest. I know him more as the sort of the icon, the saviour of the world image than he was as a musician. So I'll take your word for it, Harlan, because you know what you're talking about.
It's a rare thing for anyone to say to me. So we'll be coming back to John May in a wee while and very much looking forward to speaking with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Adrienne, since we did Creativity number 4, a little bird told me that you're getting into the acting business.
Yes, it occurred to me as my hair went whiter and whiter that there might be another area of work specifically for people with white hair, namely acting, advertising, extras work. And so I thought I'll give it a shot. And so I did. I signed up with an agency and I did my first job on Sunday on a shoot, and it was just like it is on Extras with Ricky Gervais. It was everything that Extras is: the food queue, the bus that you sit on for your meals, etc. And being me, I knew nothing about this production whatsoever. Anyway, in the end, I ended up as an elderly lady in a wheelchair with an oxygen mask on in the back of a lift, being escorted by an extremely handsome young man as my porter.
He's an extremely handsome and rather famous young man. Is that correct?
Not quite yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm jumping the gun. So another extra.
As the porter.
Okay.
And so the run was they just kept rehearsing and rehearsing. And this couple kept coming into the lift. And then they go cut. And then we do it again and again. And they say, okay, we're going for a take. And in between, this young guy took us out of the lift because it was so hot. And I turned to him and I said, you know, that bloke looks extremely like really famous actor who I love. And he said, it is and I nearly fell out of the wheelchair and the woman that was with him. And he said, and that is
She is definitely one of my favourite actors.
Yes.
I think she's amazing.
I know. So we were with the creme de la creme and they were like 3 feet away from us.
So you can't tell us the names, because if you do, they'll have to kill you. Is that right?
My career would be over before it started, and I would get my legs smacked very hard.
So we'll just have to wait until your movie debut comes out.
You will have to wait, and it could take a long time. But overhearing other extras talking was really funny, how they get their movie and they fast forward and then they pause it at the point where they were and they say, and they just got my back in.
Yes.
Or I wasn't in there at all after all that. So there is a sort of pride in the work. It was one of the most fun days I've had for ages and ages. So I hope it carries on.
So it didn't bore you to death hanging around and hanging around?
There was so much hanging around, but you're in really good company, really great people. Mm. Plus, the whole process is utterly fascinating. And now I'm watching things on TV and thinking, they've timed that policeman handing her that cup of coffee.
Yes.
They've probably rehearsed it about 6 times before they actually filmed it. Mm. So it kind of opens up a whole other world.
Were you on location or were you in a studio?
No, we're on location.
The whole traveling circus thing was, you were part of.
Absolutely. And the bus and the food was great. You know, you do. The experience was very positive because I was expecting to be treated like cattle or something. Not at all. They do have to an extent, say, right, everybody go over there and everybody come here. But we were treated with extreme politeness and cheeriness, and we just had a really good time.
Right. And remind me the names of the actors that you were talking about.
Not allowed. No. I wish I could. I'm bursting at the seams, but I can't.
It's a big movie, presumably.
Yes, I thought it was some little television short.
We look forward to more information as and when you can reveal it.
I will look forward to revealing it.
We'll be looking for an elderly lady in a wheelchair with an oxygen mask.
But I'm just picking up that you don't talk about something that you're involved in.
So do you recommend this activity to people of a certain age, that all you have to do is turn up and sit in a wheelchair and wear an oxygen mask?
I read an article actually by a woman in her 80s who said she suddenly got the idea of being an extra and it was a whole new lease of life for her. And of course, you're niche because you've got white hair and you're elderly. Mm. So life insurance and being grannies and all of that, you've got it. They want you.
Yeah.
And now I've noticed a lot of fashion modelling are using older women and with white and grey hair. So I think there's a definite niche in the market for it, if anyone out there is even vaguely considering it. But you do need, it is quite expensive to get your portfolio done, all your photographs done.
Right.
But I was absolutely gobsmacked when I saw the results, because I go, is that me? That doesn't look like me, because they know exactly how to put outfits together and how to shoot you and all of that. So that was great fun as well.
When I first came to live in Budapest, I was doing a little bit of extras work and a few speaking parts in movies, but mostly I was asked if I could be a presenter. And the presenter I was asked to imitate quite a lot was Jeremy Clarkson. He was sort of loud and boisterous.
Sorry, say that again, Harlan.
Was asked not to physically imitate,
okay,
but to present as if I was Jeremy Clarkson, because at the time people thought that was the absolute height of punchy, fun presenting.
Right.
And then after a while, I then got a job where the agency said, what we're looking for is somebody who's really like Morgan Freeman. So that was my next gig. So I was being other people and
right,
not really particularly enjoying it, not least because my memory was not good enough even then to remember whole strings of lines. I don't know how Morgan Freeman does it, for instance, maybe because he's a professional actor. And then one day I was asked if I could do a voiceover as a dog.
Uh-huh.
So I said, yeah, sure. They said it's for an American company. You'll be doing an online audition and recording. So I was practicing my American dog voices. And I went to the audition stroke recording. The production company was in Los Angeles. And they were saying, can you say various test lines like, hey, man, I want a bone. And I'd go, okay, hey, man, I want a bone. And they go, no. It's got to be more southern than that, you know. So I'd try my terrible range of non-existent American accents, by which time they were getting sort of desperate and saying, okay, relocate to New York, make it New York. And I was equally hopeless with all of these. At which point I said, I'm awfully sorry. I just don't seem to be able to get this for you. And the guy at the other end of the line said, brilliant. That's the voice we need. That weird voice you've just done. I said, that's my voice. And he said, this Australian voice thing, it's great. It sounds really good. So we'll record that. So I got to do three words as a Dachshund using my weird Australian voice. And it's the gift that keeps on giving of all the work like that that I've done. Every so often, I'll get a royalty statement saying, we hope you don't mind, but we'd like to pay you a little bit more because we're now using this in Argentina or Canada or something.
Wow.
So that's my history as an extra stroke presenter stroke sausage dog.
Wow. I mean, that's the pinnacle, isn't it? There's no aspirations left. You climbed Mount Everest there.
I pretty much felt like that, yes.
When I went to do the costume fitting, I went as myself and the costumer just walked in and went, oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. Too cool. But we wanted twin set and pearls. And I said, well, if you told me, I could have given you twin set and pearls. So we got around it by putting me in a nightdress. But it is a problem because, like you, I don't dress like a grandparent.
No.
I mean, I'm not a grandparent anyway. You know, I don't wear twin set and pearls.
I'm pretty willing to bet that most of the people who listen to this podcast don't look like the traditional idea of grannies and granddads of oldies.
I bet too, which is where I think the modelling thing, that is what they want.
Mm.
If they're asking you to model clothes. But I think for film work and plays, they probably still do, you know, that the other extra that was there with the white hair, she was cast as a granny and she looked like a granny, but that's how she looked.
Hang on, what do you mean she looked like a granny? You're following the stereotype.
Well, she looked like the stereotype of a granny.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I've spent the last 13 years trying to look conventional to do funerals. You know, I'm willing to change my appearance to a degree, but I'm not willing to change my everyday appearance for anybody.
Now, you've just opened up a whole other story there, Adrienne. You spent 13 years doing funerals.
Yeah.
You mean you're a grave digger or what?
I was and still am a funeral celebrant, which is the person who runs or organises and then conducts, is the correct word, non-religious funerals. But as you say, that's a whole other area to talk about.
We've got to come back to this in some future podcast.
It's a fascinating area and it's full of fun and wonderful anecdotes. And I could really literally write a book.
Perhaps you ought to.
The thing is, nobody wants to read a book about funerals, particularly, I don't think. And
why,
other
why not?
People have done. I don't know. I met a couple of bearers, as we call them. You know, these are the guys that carry coffins in and out of the chapel and have written a book, but said, you know, it's only of real interest to people already in the industry.
Well, we're all going to die.
I suppose so. No, it's just another thing to put on my list of to-dos.
I think you should push it up the list because it's really interesting, that work, I would have thought.
It's fascinating. It's deeply rewarding. It's opened up my view of humanity.
In a good way?
In a very good way, to not just walk past people in the street because there's a huge backstory to that situation that you might not know. I mean, we did have to go back in one day and pull a young boy off a coffin. He was just absolutely distraught and draped across this coffin of a guy who lived on the streets, who was an alcoholic. But he was such a wonderful person. Everybody loved him.
No.
Anyway, I'm digressing, but there's loads of stories like that.
Okay, well, I think we should devote one of our podcasts to that kind of story and maybe things about death, dying.
Death, dying, yeah. I know someone who would be the perfect guest when she's very busy at the moment, I know, but she actually started an entire movement over here in the UK.
Okay, then we have to speak with that person.
We do indeed.
Now, we have to speak with another person coming right on up.
Hooray!
We heard his music right at the start, John May, who describes himself as a generalist, an archivist. I guess he's a poetist and a musicianist, all kinds of things. So, Adrienne, can you introduce John and then we'll get him on the line?
Our esteemed guest today is John May. who has a CV of some length. So I'm just going to read out some of his achievements, and then he can take it from there on whatever aspect of it he wants to talk about. He's an investigative journalist. He wrote for the NME, that's the New Musical Express, as Dick Tracy. He's interested in counterculture, environmentalist. He's an archivist, an author of 18 books. He's a musician, a songwriter, a poet, a photographer. He has a blog called The Generalist, and he's a young elder. So, John, over to you.
Hi, John.
So where should we start then?
Wherever you wish to, darling.
Well, I've been thinking about my biography, obviously.
Uh-huh.
One reaches a certain point where you think, well, I ought to maybe try and write some of this down. So when I was a kid, I collected everything. Matchbox labels, cigarette cards, things I'd found in the garden, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And my parents were musicians. My dad worked for a company that distributed magazines and newspapers. So when I was a kid, he'd come back with the latest comics that had just come off the printers, Beano and Daddy and Eagle and all those sorts of things. So I think from an early age, I was fascinated with loads of things. And I had collections. That was quite the key thing. So I'm now doing it on a much bigger scale. But it's a similar process. I mean, I'm still clipping newspapers, you know, which is not something many people do. And I love filing. They have to be in chronological order.
Is this always print that you're filing and collecting, or are you still doing matchbox labels and items?
Not so much. I've got a large badge collection.
Mm-hmm.
But my archive has been visited by the British Library, and the academics, they always say, oh, it's quite well organised. Because obviously, if somebody like me, they think, oh, it's probably be, you know, a mess kind of thing. I was part of a Somerset House summer exhibition for 3 months, which was about alternative magazines. So I had two big glass cases with my stuff in it, which was very exciting. Jimmy Page was there on the opening night.
Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin.
Of course it was.
What is the impetus behind collecting, especially magazines? Is it for you, or are you thinking, I want to share these treasures with the world?
It's not just magazines. I mean, it's an analog archive, which means that my whole journalistic life, I've got the piece I wrote for Time Out. I've got the letter I wrote to the editor, invoices. What I wanted to do was to leave something that, you know, show what it was like to be a freelancer in my time span.
Mm.
And I've got something like 100 more interviews, which have been digitized. But apart from that, it's paper and everything. And I just find it endlessly fascinating. And going back to the connectivity, that's my driving force, connectivity. Everything's connected on every level. And that's a very profound, almost Buddhist understanding of the world. And that's what I believe in, and that's what I'm interested in. And I think educationally, we don't do our children any favors by forcing them into different categories. We need to be looking at the world in a much more connective way if we're to carry on with the human race.
Okay, yeah.
So in a sense, John, in my eyes anyway, you are the curator of a golden age. You've interviewed people like William Burroughs, who to me is a sort of distant god, who I'd be terrified
yes.
of, by the way.
Yes.
You've been on the tour bus with BFOT. This is a...
Yes.
To keep that... as you are, and to categorize it and hold it for future generations, because now younger people are getting so interested in that era.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. Yeah, I have a lot of people have come to look at it, particularly guys and girls in their 20s. And yeah, exactly as you say, they're really interested and fascinated with it. My main concern now is I need an industrial building to house it properly and make it available to everybody. So if you know anybody who's got a few spare millions, that would be handy.
Can I just rewind? Did I hear correctly that Adrienne said you were on the tour bus with Beefheart, as in Captain Beefheart?
Yeah, I was. This is due to my friend Nick Kent, who at the time was the best music writer going, him and Charles-Sean Murray and a few others.
Mm.
And so I just tagged along on his tail. The thing is, if you've led a life like mine, you've got a lot of anecdotes. And being in the coach with the captain, very briefly, the coach broke down on the way to Brighton from London, and we were marooned halfway between. It was a summer evening, and there was chatting to the captain, who was telling me about his night paintings, which he did in the desert. He used to only paint at night. And Winged Eel Fingling and all the others were there. An amazing, you know. And then by the time we arrived, about 45 minutes late or something like that or more, and the audience was just, you know, crazy. And it was just such an amazing gig. And just a final little thing, we were in the dressing room. The captain's got a spangled black cloak with golden stars on over it and a hat. And this kid comes in. He can't be more than 10 years old or something like that. He came in to get his autograph, and he's shaking. He's shaking with fear. The captain comes over, just puts his hand on the boy's shoulders, calms him down, sits him down, and spends about half an hour talking to him, you know.
Hmm. Yeah.
You'd say I've been very fortunate. You know, I've been in a room with Spielberg and George Lucas and William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and many, many other important people, should we say.
Mm. Of course, these people are like gods to us. I'm still very starstruck even in my older years. Really important that you've got these recollections and stories to share.
And this is where the autobiography comes in. Before I forget everything, I better get something down.
You mentioned Charles-Sean Murray and Nick Kent, who I remember reading all those years ago. It was a time when the journalist or the reporter was as much of a star as the people that they were interviewing.
Well, it was the enemy at a certain point, at the apex of their power and glory, 1978, something like that, coming into punk. And the thing about the enemy at that time, you'd phone anybody up and you say from the enemy, they say, anything you want. Every door was open. And I was Dick Tracy, the enemy, because I wasn't writing about music mainly. I was writing about everything that wasn't music, but was connected with the music scene. And that led me to do the film section for a long time. And that was just before Star Wars, when the audience for cinemas was going like that. And IPC magazines owned the enemy. And I was taken up to the board level. And there was the heads of all the film distribution companies in Britain. And they just said to me, anything you want, John, anything you want. So I've been extremely fortunate in that regard. I mean, the first time I got on a plane, I went to Hollywood to meet George Lucas.
Mm.
I'd been told that I had more access to Star Wars than anybody else at that time.
Were you in part responsible for breaking it? Do you feel like you ushered in the Star Wars era in some ways?
Well, we were doing a licensed magazine, Star Wars Monthly,
mm-hmm.
financed by Felix Dennis, the famous publisher and crazy man, who was wonderful. I loved him dearly. He had the rights to do these magazines. What I did do was the making of The Empire Strikes Back. Up to that point, special effects and everything else was a bit of a secret in filmmaking. And I think it's one of the first ever sort of going behind the scenes. And of course, it was between the analog and the digital.
Mm-hmm.
Industrial Light and Magic had one computer at the time. And the universe in Star Wars was a piece of black velvet with fiber optic cables. That was the whole universe. Then they had a big industrial unit full of plastic model kits. That was how they made all the ships and everything else.
Mm.
That always impresses younger people.
I enjoy the making of films more than I enjoy the films quite often. I find it's absolutely fascinating. And looking back on these old films, people say, do you realise that there were no special effects in those days?
Well, not special effects as such, but they did have model making and all that kind of
thing. Right.
There's a great documentary with Keanu Reeves looking at filmmaking, analogue and digital, and every stage of the filmmaking is one better than the other and so on. You know, it's very interesting.
Yeah. You're a bit of a Dylan aficionado as well, John. Did you ever get to meet him?
No. Bob Dylan haunted me like he does millions of others. My mum bought me a guitar when I was 14, and I was just learning to play, and he brought out another side of Bob Dylan, which had poetry on the back. And, you know, I just thought I'd just give up now. You know, I didn't get a band together until I was almost 50 as a result. But we didn't have any songs, so I had to write a lot of songs. But before that, I did always play guitar and everything at parties and things like that and make things up. But yeah, no, he's a colossal figure, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. You're domiciled in Lewes, a historic town in East Sussex. And just at the end of lockdown, you got a group of us all together in the upstairs room of a pub to celebrate him and his birthday. And that was the first time we'd all been out, I think. It was a colossal evening. It was amazing.
What was amusing, I only invited people who I bumped into in the street. There wasn't any advertising. So I assumed those were the people who meant to be there. It's wonderful that you were there and people were crying.
That was a great evening on so many levels, wasn't it?
And I did another series called The Happenings, which you were also kind enough to participate in, which was 10 acts, 15 minutes each, three songs.
It was brilliant, all of them.
We were just coming out of the pandemic, so none of the audience had seen a live music thing for ages. And the musicians hadn't played for ages. And the combination was colossal. Honestly, people were saying, this is what we need. You know, it was so emotional. And I did five of those. And that atmosphere was in them all. It was fantastic.
Are you still doing them?
No.
Okay.
It was very much of the time. I don't feel I can repeat myself in that respect. I'm always trying to think of new ways of putting on events. To simplify things, you know, that's something I've always done since I was at school almost.
Yeah.
And particularly now, I just want to sort of reinvent the gig, reinvent the event, you know, otherwise it's just a bit boring. We're in a new age. We're in a scary transitional point between one type of society and another. And that's another whole section of the work that I've done over the years, which is to do with environmental issues. So I wrote the history of Greenpeace and I ran their international publishing operation, produced books on Antarctica, dolphins, the oceans. You know, I bought Al Gore lunch on the eve of the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. That summit was the Earth Summit. It was meant to solve the problems of the Earth and bring all the world leaders together. It was the biggest collection of world leaders at that time. And so, I interviewed Al Gore. I bought him lunch, you see.
I'm tempted to say, what did you have?
He was going to Gatwick, so I got in the car with him and I had my recorder with me. And it was like one of those movies, you know, you're interviewing the President of the United States. You know. I mean, I was writing about the environment since 1971, and I've got a huge amount of material to do with all that. So I'm still working away on climate change issues and things like that. So that's very dear to my heart.
Mm.
How can I put it to you? There's a whole other side to me, which is my mum was quite psychic. She could say something and you said, well, how did you know that? She didn't make any great claims for it, but she was very, oh, I was just thinking about Audrey and the phone rang and it was Audrey. That was the kind of magic.
Yeah.
As you see, but I'm always ahead. I'm very tuned into the zeitgeist. That's a journalist's job, to try and understand what are these waves of things that are going through society and how they're feeling. That comes out in music and films and poetry. At the moment, poetry is huge. Punk is huge. And it fluctuates consistently. And, you know, I just wake up in the morning, present myself to the world and go out and just see what's going down. And what with the internet and everything else, I get masses of stuff come in through the door, through the thing, email, you know, like most other people, but just times 10, which is delightful for me. I mean, this is, you know, I'm in my element. You can see my office there. The room that I work in. And you can see there's quite a lot of books up there. Well, there's four floors of that, which is exciting and interesting.
So where do you think things are going? You were talking about being ahead of the zeitgeist. What's happening? What are you hearing?
We're waiting for the people to get themselves organized, because they've had to take on, you know, huge amounts of stuff. The changes, the pandemic, etc., all the other stuff that's going on. So the existing structures whereby people got together were pretty much shattered by all these different things. It's like, well, there's too many things. But there are definite signs, I would say, that interest in the counterculture is one sort of barometer, if you like. The idea of squatting or sort of living in communes and all that kind of thing. What I'm trying to promote at the moment is the what we call the arts labs. There were two in London initially, which pioneered the whole thing. And it was like French foreign films, and John and Yoko were there, and all the leading playwrights were there. And there was Electronica. That spread to 50 other places in Britain. We had one in Worthing called the Worthing Workshop. We were like 18, 19, putting on gigs. We had a folk club, and we sold underground newspapers and created a certain amount of trouble and got arrested a lot. That was the joy of that particular exercise. But that was the idea of the Arts Lab. And then every 3 months you'd go to Guildford to meet the others in the southeast area and to chat about this, that, and the other. So bands had a sort of circuit that they could go on. Because I came across a new book, The History of the London Arts Labs. And that fired me up again, particularly when I went to the end of the book. And it's got all the 50 things, including my thing, which says Worthing Workshop did a mass bubble in, which was on TV or something. And, £5, you can go and see the Never Evers at this. And then it had my mum's address, 60 Brookdean Road, which is the phone number there. That's typical of me, you see. If I start thinking about something, inevitably somebody else connected to it will turn up, or it seems to be absolutely in tune, you know. Obviously, it doesn't work like that all the time, but that's what I'm about. And the other thing is, I, as Adrienne listed, I do flirt between a variety of expressions. You know, I bought my first camera in 1979 to go to Hollywood. And recently, I'm getting quite good. I like my pictures now. Poetry, I've got mounds of poetry here. Never quite sure whether it's any good. This is another whole story, but it's a little book that was commissioned for the millennium, the Book of Sussex Revelations, and it was an epic poem with 12 paintings. And I wrote the epic poem, and my friend Pete Mercer did the paintings. This was in a big box, and you open the box, and the whole thing comes out like a concertina. It's 26 feet long. So you've got picture, text. And then we made a tiny one, and it started in Lewes, and then it went through 15 libraries on tour, and we lost track of it. So 2 years later, it's like, where is the box? So it then took me 10 years to find the box. Last year, I thought I'm going to have a last go trying to find this thing, and I did actually manage to find it at the last moment in Hastings Library. And so we were able to put it on display in an art gallery. And people were coming in, and the very first people who came in, they said, thank you so much for writing this beautiful poem about our county. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of very emotional reactions people had to the whole thing. So I'm now a poet, officially. I think you have to do it for a long, long time, and then there's something happens and you can feel confident saying, I am that person.
Yeah.
Theatre-wise, when I was at school, I was in various plays, as we all were, and recently somebody pointed out to me a book that had been written about the plays at Stenning Grammar School. You know, my dad died when I was 9, and I was sent away to boarding school for 7 years or something. You can imagine that's why I am the way I am. Don't mess with me. And going back briefly, and I played the sprite in The Tempest. And there's reviews in this book. The first one says, this is probably the greatest aerial performance I've ever seen, or something like that. It was like, and the next one was even better. Never in the history of theatre I had a trained voice by that time. My mother was very much a stage mother, always pushing me on, go on, John, go on. That sort of thing. And I had elocution lessons, piano lessons, singing lessons, how to hold yourself when you've got the accompanist there. You know, I was in music festivals and things like that. So all these things together. So when I have an idea, is it a book, a record, a thing? It gets confusing.
Sure.
What about this upcoming book about medieval society? I can see why you're interested in our current society. Future society, why are you interested in looking back to medieval times?
Virtually everything that I've done has come out of the blue, and this is just another out of the blue thing. My friend, who's a wood carver, beautiful stuff that he does, he's a sort of attached member to this small group of people who were the beginning of this whole thing about restaging battles and all the rest of it. And they were quite a unique, small outfit that pioneered understanding about that whole thing, investigated exactly how the swords were and all the... They were obsessed with all the details, and that changed everybody's thinking. So my friend said they'd like a book done, so that's it.
Why not?
Yeah. It's good fun. I'm just open to it all, except when obviously I'm miserable from time to time. But going back to the raising, you know, from the ground up, that is the model for getting things going. Small things in lots of places, and they all begin to know each other. So there's a net of stuff, and then things start happening.
Mm. The nearest thing to that is the samba movement. I used to play samba. You know, you go to Edinburgh and there's the Edinburgh Samba group, and go to London, there's the London Sambistas, and there's instant rapport because you're all in love with music form, and you can come off the streets with no musical skills whatsoever and take part. So it's something like that, not exactly that.
Right? Yeah, but there's no real coherence. Take music, there's not any music papers like there was. That would catch what was happening in Yorkshire or Liverpool or Edinburgh or anything else. Before it gets into the mainstream, there's loads of stuff going on. The punk movement is pretty large, and metal, of course, and electronica is big. There is all this stuff going on, but we haven't managed to cohere. It could begin here.
Exactly. This is about how do you keep your creativity going, which is what this is all about, really, John, because you never seem to stop or take a break.
Take some Guinness and pick up the pen and you start writing, but you're not allowed to stop page after page. So I've got 38 pages of stuff. I enjoy bars because there's conversation. That's where things happen. And, you know, what's not to like? The birds are out at the moment. Things are happening.
Yeah.
You know, I do like the Buddhist approach to life, really, which is one day at a time is obviously, you know, a useful approach. People worry about the future and the past all the time. It's like, it's just now, here and now. You can tell I was a hippie at one point.
No way.
Then I got arrested. Then I became a freak.
So how do you categorize yourself now, John?
Oh, well, I do like young elder. I had a photo taken of me when I was 71, and I was holding a book from the past. So it was 71-17. I have the feelings I had when I was a kid. Like many others, I was pretty brutalized at school and then arrested and strip searched and fingerprinted. It just changes you.
Mm.
You know, I'm about peace and love beyond anything else, connectivity. If you think about the French Revolution, where church and state dictated everything. Then on the other side, you've got the beginning of science and the Industrial Revolution. And in between, you've got Diderot and the encyclopedias, 26 volumes of the new thinking. What I'd like people to understand is that the acceleration of science in every field, because of global connectivity, artificial intelligence, satellite, and I read a lot of scientific magazines, and dramatic changes. Just the pictures of the universe from the new telescope is just, here's all my astronomy books. I shall now put them in the bin. The other one I always talk about is the gut. You know, when I was at school, nobody told me I had a gut. I thought that's my tummy down here. No, my tummy's up there. This is the gut, and it's got a brain. Really? It's got a cable going directly into the brain because the brain's in a box and it wants to know what's happening downstairs. Plus, you're carrying an ecosystem inside you, which is like 165,000 types of little things. It immediately makes you feel different. You know, you're carrying this inside you. So I'm constantly excited. Can I just say about my blog? I started when blogs were something, you know. Blogs now is a bit antique-like, but nevertheless, you know, I still put stuff up there. I did that because you couldn't get paid anymore. I was earning some kind of living from freelance journalism, and it just wasn't there. But to be able to have your own channel was really exciting. I mean, the first day that I wrote, or the first month, I did like 35 posts. This game. Oh my goodness, you know.
I get the sense that you're an information magpie, if that's not a rude description of you.
Beyond a magpie. It's like I'm more or less like this all the time. Because every day there's a new amount of inputs, and there's so many different exciting things. I mean, music, Arcade Fire in New Orleans, live concert. Oh, or Nina Simone. And music's so important, isn't it? It's from the heart. It's to raise people's spirits and all the rest of it.
Got so, me through lockdown. Do you get obsessions with one particular band or form of music?
I have periods where I don't play any music at all, and then all of a sudden back to the vinyl. At the moment, it's jazz and electronica. I mean, music's just a wonderful thing.
How, anyone listening, how can they best get hold of you or see your work or contact you?
There's an archive thing, the Generalist Archive. We'll find it, I think. And then my blog is The Generalist. And then I'm on Facebook and Twitter. It's very good for me to talk to you like this because I have to get some of this stuff out there. Or at least try and encourage people to think that we can actually do something about things if we just get off our proverbial backsides. And, you know, why not?
Do you find it more difficult, though, to get up off your proverbial backside since the pandemic? I think it's had a huge effect on people that's probably unconscious.
I was spent a large part of the time with, we created the Fresh Air Music Movement. So we were sitting on pavements a lot and playing music. We were doing this at sort of 6 o'clock at night, and all the mums and the babies, they said, oh, it's so lovely. The babies were loving it. So maybe there's a new role for me here, you know.
Yeah.
I prefer singing in the street than anywhere else, really.
Do you feel like a wise old greybeard these days, or are you still that 17-year-old you talked about?
I don't feel that at all. How old do you think I am?
I think you and I are contemporaries, so I think we're both in our early 70s.
Yep, this month, 73, yeah.
Okay.
So we're saying to the world, just because you're in your 70s doesn't mean you can't do anything.
Exactamente.
You know, it's my job to just energize things. When I was in Paris once, they said to me, you are an animateur. So I'm good from nothing to something. It's my job to get things off the ground.
Well, long may it continue, John.
Well, thank you very much.
Much needed and vital.
Thanks a zillion. It's been very stimulating. It's been very enjoyable.
Good. Well, you're welcome anytime.
Great to see you. Bye.
Thanks, John. Lots of love.
Thanks.
See you. Thanks.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Fading away. Wow, that was really enjoyable, Adrienne.
It was yummy. And I do think what John's doing and carrying is really, really important for the coming generation, not just for us, but for people who are really keen to find out what exactly happened at that point in time. Because there was so much going on, wasn't there? It was really special.
Very much so. Although I was interested in what John was saying about activism. I was interested because I was reflecting on my own activities and thought, what did I do? You know, how many marches did I go on? Virtually zero. How many times did I protest against what used to be called the man? And almost zero. What about you?
Really? You surprised me. What can I say? Recently, we had a march here in Brighton in the UK, which is where I currently live. And it was in support of the people going on strike, postal workers and railway workers and so on. So off we go. And this very young girl came and walked beside me. And she said, I expect you've seen a few of these, haven't you? I said, only about 30 to 40 years worth.
Mm-hmm.
Because even when we were at the same college in Maidstone, and they were trying to take it over for office building, it was something like that. They didn't want us there. And so I think I remember we all marched and we stood in front of the council buildings in silence. And then we took the college over for, I think, 3 days. So we all got so sweaty and stinky. And then previous to that was Aldermaston, of course. So it started there. And then the women's movement, we marched. The war against Iraq, we marched. I was in Lisbon then, and we were marching in Lisbon.
Mm.
And more recently, since Brexit, it's been incredible. You know, pro-European, another women's march, the Me Too movement, BLM. It just feels like a constant thing. With humour as well, a little story about going the very first women's march I went on in London. Of course, in those days, some men would stand and jeer at us, which is fair enough. That's where they're from. The one that we really cracked up of is a load of Morris dancers standing there with their handkerchiefs, you know, waving in protest at us. And we just fell about laughing. But I do occasionally now reflect back and think, what was it all for?
Mm.
Why did we bother having a women's movement when I see what's going on right now, particularly, you know, you're looking at things like the police and firemen, all misogynists. It's incredible. And what young girls are doing to their bodies, it makes me want to weep. It's frightening. The body dysmorphia. So, oh, and Greenham Common. I didn't mention Greenham Common. I mean, what those women did was amazing when you think about
it. I agree.
And they turned those missiles back. So I'm trying to answer my own question, but I think it can and does make change. The suffragettes got us the vote, even if it just raises awareness. And I think bottom line is, if you're on one of those marches, you feel really good.
Mm.
It's got such a great feeling that I'm doing something, even if it's just waving a placard.
For me, I've always felt that the personal is what's important.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I've done things which help make change. For example, doing creativity workshops with prisoners, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But standing on my hind legs in a crowd of thousands and thousands has never got to me. And I look at other people that have done that, and I respect that. And I listen to John talking about being an activist and how he was often arrested.
Yeah.
And I think, good on you, mate. You put yourself on the line.
Yeah. And it doesn't suit everybody. And but there's our good mutual friend, Dirk Campbell, recently, I don't know if you saw that, went to a really right-wing conservative conference and actually elbowed Lord Snooty out of the way.
Who's Lord Snooty?
What's he called?
Is this Rees-Mogg?
Rees-Mogg, yeah. And Rees-Mogg does that little patronising smile, and Dirk's saying, this is where fascism begins, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, it was probably arrested. He was carted off. He's been arrested so many times.
Things like climate activism, I'm also very impressed by people who've put themselves on the line for that. And I'm thinking, for example, a couple that we know, Roger and Caroline Hillier,
mm-hmm.
who back in the 70s were doing stuff like recycling, and they'd put old radiators on the roof of their house, which were used to use solar energy to heat the water in the house. And I think most people, myself, I'm ashamed to say, thought they were bonkers.
Oh, yeah. It's only very, very slowly dawned on me what these people have been on about for years.
Yeah.
It's taken a long time for it to sink in. And I think there is the danger of seeing it as a white middle class form of activism and consciousness anyway. And some of the elements, I did go up to one of them in London, and there were an awful lot of people sitting around playing bongos very badly. I just kept thinking, nobody is going to take this seriously in Westminster. So all the Westminster suits are going by. And there were these two women with guitars. tying yellow ribbons around a lamppost. And they were saying, tie a yellow ribbon for democracy. I just wanted to curl up and die. And all these suits are going by. I'm probably thinking, hell? And I'm sorry if I've offended anybody by saying that.
Which bit? The yellow ribbons or the...
That whole view of demonstration and does it work and why it possibly doesn't.
Well, if anyone listening to this has got their views on this, we'd love to hear from you. Are you the sort of person who goes out and protests? Or are you the sort of person who stays at home and thinks about it or writes a song about it instead? What's your take on this, on activism, which John May introduced in today's interview, talking about how he has been an activist all of his life?
And, of course, activism and songs can be very, very powerful. I mean, Dylan, supposedly the voice of a generation, I mean, you know, introduced himself to the musical world as a protest singer. Well, he didn't, other people named him. That was an actual label, protest singing.
Sure, yeah.
So keep doing it.
And John has been keeping on with all sorts of activities, activism and his collections that he talked about, and also his music. So we began the show with one of his tracks. Do you think we should finish the show with one of his tracks?
Oh, yes.
So we're going to play out with, I think, an intriguingly titled song. It's called I Keep Waking Up in Your Dreams.
Isn't that great?
Rather than what I would think of as the other way around, you keep waking up in mine. But I Keep Waking Up in Your Dreams by John May, our guest today, from his album Boho Solo.
Lovely.
So here's John with the play out. Goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Hope to see you, hear you, hope to be with you all next time.
Bye.
Every night I keep waking up in your dreams. Every night I keep waking up in your dreams. Doesn't seem so right that it should have to be this way. All I wanted was the chance to make it all okay. You turned your back to me, I couldn't make that final step. But your face showed that you didn't wanna leave me yet. Every night I keep waking up in your dreams. Every night I keep waking up in your dreams. Sitting in a bar, rehearsing all my moves and words. Feeling nervous, trying to find the funky groove. You walk in and smile across the crowded neon smoke. Sometimes life just seems to be a cosmic joke. Every night I keep waking up in your dreams. Every night I keep waking up in your dreams. Now I'm older, it's just crazy how you made me feel. But at least you made me really real. I'm still checking it out, grooving along, doing my scene. You still keep finding ways of playing inside my dreams. Every night I keep waking up in your dreams. Every night in your dreams, in your dreams, baby. Every night I keep waking up in your dreams.
Creativity. If you think you're too old to be creative, or too creative to be old, tune in to the Creativity Podcast.